title of the lesson, as you can see, is Serving God Conveniently. And this is a very relevant, very practical lesson. And if you don't mind, I'd like to start off with some illustrations, that is, before I get into the PowerPoint presentation. Speaking of PowerPoint, I did mean to say also, if I may interrupt my train of thought for this, that I do appreciate Jerry Falk making up these PowerPoint presentations to go with the lesson. He relieves me of a big burden in doing that. So I really, really do appreciate his making up these PowerPoints to go with my sermons. Besides that, he would just do a lot better job at it, I think, than I would. I mean, he comes up with such great pictures, doesn't he? I also say that to say, if you ever have a problem with the PowerPoint, you know whose fault that is. So you can go and talk to Jerry about that. Serving God conveniently. We're often confronted with decisions that we have to make in our lives as to how we're going to serve God, because it's not unusual for there to be a conflict between our conveniences, or what we would want to do on one hand, and what we ought to be doing in serving God on the other hand. Let me give you some examples that might come across as more difficult or extreme examples before I advance in the PowerPoint presentation. To give you an example, to give you examples of how difficult it can be to make these kinds of choices. Years ago, while we were living here, I got a phone call from a nationally known preacher of the gospel, and he wanted to know about churches that were meeting in the New York City area, because he was going to have occasion, evidently with some other brethren, our sisters, to be in New York City, because apparently he was part of a group of Christians who had been invited to come to Carnegie Hall in New York City and perform there. It's part of some singing group. I don't know if it was a barbershop group or some such group or whatever it was. But this was evidently a great honor. I mean, I've never been invited to sing at Carnegie Hall. Not that I expect that kind of thing, but it would be a great honor, wouldn't it? I suppose. That's a big deal. But apparently the performance was going to be on Sunday. Oh, so there's a conflict in brewing there, isn't there? You know, because you need to worship God with your brethren on Sunday, as the Scriptures direct. But on the other hand, you've had bestowed upon you or your group this great honor to sing at Carnegie Hall. So he was, I guess, experiencing this problem, trying to work it out so he could satisfy both his responsibility to meet with God's people on Sunday, to worship God, and also satisfy this great desire to accept this great honor to sing at Carnegie Hall. So how was he going to do that? Well, apparently his first thought was, let me check on the churches in the New York City area to see if I can get to one of them, and maybe in the afternoon make it back to Carnegie Hall to sing there, to perform. And so I think I said, well, it looks to me like the church in Brooklyn, this might have been even before the Upper West Manhattan group had started, I think. Might have been, probably was even before that time. So I said, it looks to me like, you know, the closest group to you, to where you're going to be performing, is over there in Brooklyn. And so I might have given him the phone number of one of the brethren to contact over there in that church, so they would be able to go and get back to Carnegie Hall in time to perform. Well, sometime later, I don't think it was too much later, there was a gathering, a social gathering of brethren. I think it was some sort of picnic that had been arranged, and one of the members of the Brooklyn church was there. And I just asked her, did you ever hear from Brother so-and-so, and did he ever make it out to Brooklyn to meet with you? And she said, no, he called and said he wasn't going to be able to make it to our assemblies, and he and his group were just going to meet in their motel room or whatever and have the Lord's Supper there or whatever and worship there, and then so they'd have time to get on to their performance. So, in order to do what he wanted to do, he cut short in some way his service to God. I don't know. Maybe you would agree with him. I don't agree with him and his choice. I can understand the profound temptation he was under. But our service to God has to come first. And I'm assuming, of course, that what the woman told me was what actually transferred. I'm going on that assumption. So those are so the kinds of, now again, this was a very difficult, I grant you that, difficult and extreme, very unusual situation. But on a lesser scale, aren't we all confronted with situations like that? I can remember not long after I had moved here, to give you another example. This was when we were still meeting on Sunday night. A brother told me, I've got these tickets to a Giants game. And you know, those tickets, I imagine they cost a lot and they're hard to come by. And maybe the Giants were playing better at that time. And you know, a lot of people wanted to get there. But this was a big deal to him. And he said, I'm going to skip tonight so I can go to the Giants game. Another example, you might say, well, you know, that's very unusual. How often do you get to go to see a Giants game? You know, but aren't we always, again, on a lesser scale, that would be unusual to us. I've never been to a pro football game in person before. So that's kind of an unusual situation that might arise. But again, on a lesser scale, aren't we confronted all the time with decisions that we have to make in which our convenience or what we want to do is a factor? Now, to get to the PowerPoint side of the presentation, it's human nature for people to make their activities as easy for themselves as possible. You know, typically we don't go out of our way to make things hard on ourselves, do we? You know, to look at the way some people live, you'd think that, but no, we try to make life as easy as possible for ourselves, right? Right? Don't we do that? That's human nature. So that's what we talk about. Let's do it the more convenient way. If we have a route to get to, we have to go to some place, we decide what's the shortest, most convenient way to get. We don't think, sit down and think, okay, what's the longest, most circuitous route to this place? No, we want to take the most convenient way. That's the way life is for us. We do things that are to our convenience. Convenience, or maybe the adjective convenient, is defined as suited to personal comfort or to easy performance. Yeah, we always want to do something the easier way. Sometimes my wife tells me, though, nevertheless, you always do things the hardest way. And she may be right. She knows she can do things more efficiently than I tend to do it. But life is driven by a desire to make it easier for us. We're always looking for ways to make life easier, aren't we? I mean, you go into the grocery store and you will see instant this, instant that. And wow, we came up with microwaves. Aren't microwaves making life in the kitchen so much more convenient, so easier? As a matter of fact, when we go home for lunch today, we're going to use the microwave, I'm quite sure. It is just so much easier than having to heat things up on the oven. We have instant coffee now. I don't use it. I prefer the old flavor of the old-fashioned way of making it, but we have TV dinners. Just all sorts. Manufacturers are always looking for ways to pull people in to buy their product because it is easier. Now, I'm not saying that this is all bad. I'm not saying that it's necessarily wrong to do something that is more convenient, or to seek out the most convenient way to do something. Not at all. As a matter of fact, ordinarily, I am for that. I am for that. Because there is nothing virtuous, per se, about going out of your way to make your life hard. Now, there are people who do that. The most prominent example are perhaps monks. God does not tell us, you know, it's better to sleep on a bed of nails rather than sleep on a feather bed or something like that, you know. There is just no virtue in deliberately trying to make life hard for us. It's a good thing to make life more efficient, more convenient for us ordinarily. The Bible does teach in its principles of good stewardship to make the most efficient use of time and material resources. I think about the Amish in their horse-drawn buggies over in Pennsylvania. And actually, I kind of like to go over there and see those sorts of things. It's kind of nostalgic. I understand that. But listen, if you can drive a car and get someplace faster and save yourself some time rather than riding in a horse-drawn buggy, you've got time to do something else. Ideally, serve the Lord during that time that you have saved by driving a car instead of going by a horse-drawn buggy. So it is in keeping with what the Bible teaches about the principles of good stewardship to make good, efficient use of our time and our resources. As a matter of fact, we know that there were those who thought that it was being more spiritual to make life hard on yourself. So, for instance, we have the Pharisee in Luke, the 18th chapter, verse 12. He fasted, he prided himself in fasting 2 times a week. Now, did the Scriptures call, Old Testament Scriptures call upon him to fast twice a week? No, not even twice a year. I think maybe the Scriptures called upon Hebrews to fast maybe 1 time a year on the Day of Atonement. But other than that, this was something that they decided to impose upon themselves. God didn't impose this inconvenience of not eating, you know, twice a week on them. So, he was condemned in that situation by the Lord. In Colossians 2, verses 20 through 23, we find those who started laying down rules. Don't touch, don't taste, don't handle. And Paul says, listen, those kinds of laws are not doing you any good. In 1 Timothy 4, verses 1 through 5, he mentions those who were forbidding to marry and forbidding people to eat certain kinds of foods and so on. That's pretty inconvenient, to say the least. But that all of that was self-imposed. God didn't direct that. So, there are people in the world who think, oh, it will make me more spiritual, or it will prove that I'm a better, more virtuous, more noble spiritual person if I deprive myself of this. I know God hasn't told me to deprive myself of this, but I'm a better person if I do. No, the Scriptures do not teach that. Then there's the other extreme. Much service of Christians, and I don't think this is surprising to us, is affected by a desire for convenience. As I said, this is not always wrong. Sometimes within the context of the church, and I've heard this word just about as long as I can remember, expediency. Or this is expedient, or this is not expedient. Within the parameters of what God has authorized and commanded, sometimes we have choices to make, options to take. He's given that to us. For instance, we have to meet on the Lord's Day, Sunday. When we do that, He has left that up to us. And we talk about, oh, it's more expedient to meet in the morning or the afternoon or the evening. And we meet in the morning here. We think that's most expedient. For us, Perth Amboy meets in the afternoon. They deem that most expedient for them. God has not specifically declared on that. But what the word expediency is basically a synonym for convenience. Why do we meet in the morning, Sunday morning, instead of in the afternoon? Well, we think this works best for us. It's most convenient for us. I say that to say, again, it's not wrong per se to pick out the times or the ways that are most expedient, convenient, if you will, for accomplishing our purposes. And yet, serving God in the most convenient manner is wrong when that convenience is purchased at the expense of spirituality. And I early on gave you at least a couple of examples of that. In such cases, convenience is simply another word for worldliness or materialism. Christians can be so involved in the effort to make life convenient that they think that religion must follow the same trend. Okay? We're always in our daily lives. We're accustomed to the idea, oh, let's do something the most efficient way, the most convenient way, the way that makes us the happiest or brings us the most pleasure or whatever. And it's very easy for that thinking to bleed over into the way that we look at how we serve God. So that people begin to think that whenever religious practice imposes something inconvenient, even rigorous or demanding or sacrificial on them, then it requires too much. Because they're accustomed to thinking, life ought to be built around my convenience. And they carry that thinking over into the way that they serve God. So they suppose that their service to the Lord must revolve around whether or not it satisfies their requirements for convenience. They do not want to be inconvenienced by their service to God. And of course, when their convenience is the overriding factor or criterion in determining what they will do or when they will do it, then what's going to happen? Well, there's going to be a gradual reduction in religious duties that they are willing to take upon themselves. And this is because religious duty can never be anything but an imposition or an inconvenience to those who look upon it as a chore. Something we've got to get done, something we've got to do. Get it out of the way so we can go up and do what we really do want to do. People who have this attitude essentially end up serving themselves rather than God. And there are scriptures which talk about people who have that kind of attitude. For instance, in Philippians 2, verse 21, and it says there, for they all seek their own interest, not those of Jesus Christ. That's the typical worldly mind right there described in chapter 3 of Philippians, verse 19. There it says, Paul is describing some with a worldly attitude whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite, and whose glory is their shame, who set their minds on earthly things. Notice the expression, whose God is their appetite. Their consumption of the pleasures and the things of this world is what rules and controls their decisions about how they're going to live their lives. What brings me the most pleasure? What is the easiest thing to do? Okay, that is, then that's what I'm going to do. Does that leave religion out? Does that leave God out? Well, yeah, I might bring God in to a certain extent, but it's going to be minimal now. If I bring God in, I'm not going to let Him in too much. I'm just going to let Him in just enough to salve my conscience. So perhaps I can think that I'm serving God faithfully, and if I die, then I will go to heaven. So I've got the best of both worlds. I serve God minimally, which gets me to heaven. And otherwise, I've got this earthly life, and I'm living it almost to the fullest. Now, needless to say, I guess you've gotten this idea by now, a religion of convenience is unacceptable. There's one key passage that tells us that. Matthew 6, verse 33. And there it says that we are to seek first God's kingdom and His righteousness. Underscore the word first there. What should have priority in our lives is God's kingdom. That's what I want to promote most of all. That's what I'm here on the earth for. I'm here to glorify God. And so seeking His righteousness and seeking His kingdom is what I want most of all as a Christian, because this is what makes the Christian different and sets him apart from the herd of this world. Because the people of this world are going to make the goal of satisfying themselves their highest priority. The Christian is not. For the Christian, everything else in this world is secondary to his service to God. All other areas and activities of life must yield to his service to God and must be made to accommodate his service to God rather than vice versa. Convenience or expediency, of course, may be taken into account, as I was saying a while ago, when considering when and how is the best time and way to serve God, to do service to God, but not whether service to God is going to be rendered. We're going to do that. That's got to come first. Now, are there options in some of them more convenient than others in how we're going to serve God? Well, then we can take those, as I was saying, but it's never going to be a choice between my convenience and my service to God. That decision should have been already made when we decided to become children of God. Too many Christians seem to feel free to excuse themselves from service to God by offering the excuse that it's not convenient for them. Oh, they might not put it in those words, but that's the problem. That's the factor. It seems to be taken for granted so often that a Christian is justifiably excused from service to God if he has something else to do. Instead, the Christian's approach to life should be, you know, I'm going to serve God first. That's the absolute necessity. And everything else in my life is going to be built around that. Now, I mentioned a while ago that sometimes this forces us into some very hard decisions. And I don't mean to sound unsympathetic. I realize that sometimes we can be put in difficult situations. We've all perhaps heard of situations where a fellow gets offered a job and it's a good paying job or whatever. But problem is he has to move to a part of the world or a part of the country where, well, there's no churches, no faithful churches. What's he going to do? He may convince himself, I'm going to start a church. One, his wife and maybe two young children who are not themselves Christians. Something like that. What's he going to do? I can't turn down that job. You know, I need that job to provide for my family. Translated, that could mean I need that job to live at the desired higher standard of living. Would we be willing to accept a lower standard of living if it means we're willing to serve God more effectively, more faithfully? Now again, as I said at the beginning of the lesson, ordinarily, it really doesn't come down to a crunch like that sometimes. I understand those are emotionally difficult decisions to make. Most of the time in our daily lives, it's something on a lesser scale. Maybe, you know, oh, I didn't get to bed until late on Saturday night, you know. And, you know, I am feeling a little bit weak today, you know, and can I just call in sick? That would be the more ordinary situation. It's not convenient in that situation, is it? For a person to get out of bed, overcome the fatigue, lack of sleep or whatever, maybe some feelings of malaise, sickness, whatever, and instead go and worship with God's people. Now, it seems like, especially since we use the word services to talk about our assemblies, that all I'm talking about here is whether we can meet with the church or not on Sunday. That is a major concern, but it should not be the only one. Oftentimes in our lives, we're confronted with temptations to do things that are wrong because they're more convenient for us. Now, I've given you some examples from my own personal experiences. Let's look at some biblical examples of people who tried to serve God according to a religion of convenience. And I'll just go through these, I hope, relatively quickly because I don't mean to scare you. I've got 9 of them, but I will try to go through them pretty quickly. In Judges, the 17th and 18th chapters, we've got an interesting story there that teaches us some important principles. Some of the outstanding characters there are a fellow by the name of Micah, and then you've got a Levite, and then you've got the Danites, or the members of the tribe of Dan. And if you were to go there to Judges, the 17th chapter, you see that there was this fellow named Michael who thought he could mingle together idolatry and the religion of Jehovah. This is Judges, the 17th chapter. Let me jump over there to it and begin reading at verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah. This is not Micah, by the way. This is farther on into the story. Of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there. Then the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem and Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem and Judah, and I'm going to stay wherever I may find a place." Micah then said to him, "Dwell with me, and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance." So the Levite went in. And the Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest." Now earlier, perhaps I should have observed this. Micah had actually created some household idols for himself and a kind of shrine. It says in verse 5, "And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest." So he was mixing together the religion of Jehovah and idolatrous religion. He probably thought he could serve Jehovah as well as some of these false gods or whatever. But you can see he's creating a religion of convenience for himself. He's got his own shrine right there where he lives, and he's serving all of these gods or recognizing all of these gods. And let me point out that, as I've said, he thought he could mingle idolatry and the religion of Jehovah. And then this Levite, let me jump ahead here about a bit. It's obvious right from the beginning that what's this Levite doing? He says he's going wherever he can find a place. What he's really saying there is he's going wherever he can find anyone who will purchase his religious services. Now, as a Levite, he was not authorized to be a priest. But now, this man Micah, he had one of his sons serving as priest, and that's even farther outside the law. What Micah recognizes, at least I've come a little bit closer to compliance with the law of God by having a Levite act as a priest, because it was a subset of the tribe of Levi, namely the sons or descendants of Aaron, who could serve as priest. So at least it's not there, but having a Levite as a priest is one step closer in the direction of compliance with God's law. It's not obedience, but it's getting there. It's getting closer, at least, put it that way. So that made Micah think, God's going to prosper me now, because at least I have a Levite for a priest. So what are both Micah and this Levite doing? They're serving God according to their convenience. They're not doing things right. Oh, they may take a step in the right direction, but they're really not doing things right. They're serving God at their convenience. Now, members of the tribe of Dan, who were eventually going to go up and attack Laish, the city of Laish, and rename it Dan after their father, our ancestor, and they were going to live there. And on the way up, they stole the household idols of Micah, and they took away his Levite, the one who served as his priest. So what are they doing? Well, they found it convenient to do this. Not only to engage in idolatry, but to steal somebody else's idols. So every character in this picture here is doing whatever is according to their convenience. They seem to feel this need for religion in some way. You know, get God into the picture, at least on the periphery of the picture, not in the center, but on the periphery. But they don't want to go too far. They don't want to inconvenience themselves in their service to God. Make it as convenient as possible. Okay, let me mention the next example. Jeroboam and the Israelites. I won't read the passage again. Jerry Falk read it a while ago. 1 Kings 12, verses 26 through 32. And here Jeroboam had led a rebellion against the son of David, not direct son of David, descendant of David, Rehoboam, actually the son of Solomon, if memory serves me, and who was reigning as king in Jerusalem. And Jeroboam, of course, had led this rebellion against him, and he had established his own kingdom over the 10 northern tribes. And he was fearful that if the citizens in his domain, who were supposed to be subject to his authority and his rule, returned to Jerusalem to worship, they would become realigned with Rehoboam, his opponent. So what did he do? He created a religion of convenience for his people. He set up golden calves, idols, at Dan in the northern extremity of his territory and at Bethel in the southern extremity of his territory. And he said, you know, it's too far for you to go down to Jerusalem. You don't have to go so far. Make it, in effect, he said, make it convenient for yourself. Just go to the place. I've given you two centers of worship. They're separated from one another so that the people in the northern kingdom can go to Dan and the people in the southern part of the kingdom can go down here to Bethel. You don't have to go so far as go to Jerusalem. He created a religion of convenience for them by creating these places of worship for them. And he offered them not just one center of worship, but two. Then there's the example of Ahab in 1 Kings, the 22nd chapter. Ahab wanted to go on a military campaign against Ramoth-Gilead, and he pulled in 400 false prophets to tell him that he had God's approval to do this. Now, what was he doing? Or what had he done? These 400 prophets were basically propagandists. Kings back then, they would have their prophets whose job it was to tell him and all those in his kingdom, whatever you want to do is all right with God. And they were probably supported out of the king's coffers for this very purpose. It was basically the ancient version of government propaganda is what these 400 prophets were. And he found a religion, he had a religion of convenience then. Now, there was one prophet, Micaiah, who was a prophet of God, but did Ahab call him in to hear what he had to say? No, he didn't want to do that until King Jehoshaphat of Judah encouraged him to do so. And then he heard what he didn't want. But see, ordinarily it was not convenient for Ahab to have someone like Micaiah come in and contradict his propagandist. Then there's the example of Naaman in 2 Kings, the 5th chapter. He was the captain of the king of Syria's army. The commander-in-chief of the army, that is. Now, Naaman, though, was a leper. And he heard that the prophet Elisha could help him out down there in Israel. So he went down to him, and Elisha doesn't even come out to him. He tells him, you know, if you want to be cured of your leprosy, then go and dip 7 times in the river Jordan. Well, Naaman was outraged. He had been inconvenienced. If it was just a simple matter of going and dipping in a river, he could have stayed home in Damascus, he says there in verses 8 through 12. And you know, I could have, why'd you bring me all the way down here just to tell me to do something like go and dip in the river? Don't you have some special incantation or ritual that you can do? You're not even coming out here to look at me. And he says, it would have been so much easier if I could have just stayed home and dipped in the rivers of Damascus, Abana, and Pharpar. That was his attitude. He thought it should, religion should have been made the most convenient for him. Then there's the example of Amaziah. This is an interesting statement that he comes out with, as recorded in Amos, the 7th chapter, verses 10 through 13. Now, Amaziah was a priest in that idolatrous city, Bethel. And Amos comes up there and starts saying some things that are not favorable to that idolatrous shrine and that are not favorable to the king there. And Amaziah, who is the priest in Bethel, you know, tells Amos that he needs to go away. And he needs to do his prophesying someplace else. Why? Because this was the kind of religion that Amaziah himself was used to. He was in the employment of a king, and he would tell the king whatever he wanted to hear. This was a religion of convenience. But let's read this, the story here in Amos 7, verses 10 through 13. There it says, then Amaziah the priest of Bethel sent word to Jeroboam, king of Israel, saying, Amos has conspired against you in the midst of the house of Israel. The land is unable to endure all his words. For thus Amos says, Jeroboam will die by the sword, and Israel will certainly go from its land into exile. Then notice what Amaziah says to Amos. Go, you seer. Flee away to the land of Judah, and there eat bread, and there do your prophesying, but no longer prophesy at Bethel, for it is a sanctuary of the king and a royal residence. And what does Amaziah mean when he tells Amos to go to Judah, and there eat bread, and do your prophesying? Well, eat bread means to get sustenance, because bread was a staple food back then. So basically, to eat bread means to do what you need to do in order to make a living, as we would say today, and eat bread, or eat and find shelter and clothe yourself with whatever necessities of life you might need. So, eat bread basically meant work, do your job, make a living. So what's he saying when he says, eat bread, go down to Judah, eat, there eat your bread, there do your prophesying? He's saying, really, we all know what your prophets do. Well, they've got, this is their job. They're not in it for sincere service to God. They're just there to make money. As we would say today, they're preaching for the money. And so he was saying, basically, this is what I do. This is the kind of religion that I'm used to practicing. You ought to do the same, Amos. You get out of here and you go where you can make money prophesying. Amaziah was used to a religion of convenience. Next example. The Jews, as described in Haggai 1, verses 2 through 5. You know, the Jews were supposed to be rebuilding the temple after their return from Babylonian exile, but they had let that work lapse. And they weren't doing it. And God sends the prophet Haggai to rebuke them. And apparently when they got rebuked, or were generally not continuing with this work of rebuilding God's house, they were saying, you know, not a good time, okay? I haven't got time right now. Or it would sound better to say, now's not a good time. Now, it's true that sometimes it's not a good or appropriate time to do some things. I don't mean to deny that. But it's also true that sometimes people will use that as an excuse. And, of course, it doesn't sound very good to say, I don't want to do that. It sounds better to say, I just don't think in my wisdom it's a good time to be doing this. When really, they just don't want to do it, period. And that was the Jews. And they got exposed. They were making their religious service as easy as possible while they attended to their own desires. Let's look what it says, beginning in Haggai 1, verse 2. Thus says the Lord of hosts, this people says, the time has not come, even the time for the house of the Lord to be rebuilt. Then the word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses while this house lies desolate? Now therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Now, what they were, he exposed them as having just made an excuse. Oh, now's not a good time to rebuild the house of the Lord. Oh, but you think it's a good time for you to start enhancing your own houses? You find time, you find money to rebuild your own personal dwellings, but you don't want to devote the time and money needed to rebuilding the house of the Lord? No, they were just being worldly and materialistic and making an excuse that, well, they made it sound as good as they could by saying, you know, it's not a good time, but they got exposed in that. So, people who forego religious service need to bear in mind, if they forego that service because it's inconvenient, they hurt themselves in the long run. Because indications are here and in Malachi 3 verses 10 through 12 that they were deprived of material blessings from God because they were not seeking Him as they should. Then there were the would-be followers of Jesus. This is a passage that might be more familiar to us, and the last paragraph of Luke 9, verses 57 through 62. There were those who were coming to Jesus and saying, I'll follow you, Jesus, but first I've got to do this or that. These people were ready to follow Jesus as long as they could do so at their convenience. I'll follow you, Lord, but first this. It's got to be done. I'll follow you, Lord, but it's got to be done at my convenience. Well, service to God cannot wait until the personal desires of people are met. We need to serve God despite our personal desires. There's the parable also of the dinner guest who made excuses because they didn't want to go to the dinner to which they had been prepared. That had been prepared for them. In Luke 16, verses 16 through 24, this story is recorded there. One man said, you know, I bought a pair of oxen and I've got to go have them checked out. Another man said, you know, I bought a parcel of land. I've got to go inspect it. Another man said, you know, I just got married and you know, I because I just got married, you know, I've got to be with my wife. And, you know. So that's the way it works sometimes. People just make excuses for not serving God. People will make any excuse, no matter how flimsy, if they do not want to accept God's invitation. But God is not deceived by excuses. Finally, I'll end up with the example of Felix in Acts 24, verses 24 through 27. Actually, in the King James Version, it says that after Paul had preached to him about righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come, and he had become frightened, King James Version says that he told Paul, go away for now, and when I find a more convenient time, I will summon you. I prefer the King James Version for that reason, because it fits in better with the theme of my lesson. Yes, Felix didn't want to hear the gospel when it was inconvenient for him. He sought Paul at a time when it was convenient to him. And when it became inconvenient, he sent him away. Sad thing is, as far as we know, Felix never found a convenient time to obey the gospel. I fear for his soul because he didn't want to serve God if it made his life inconvenient. If people are waiting until they have time or opportunity, according to their own definition of opportunity, or if they wait till they have a convenient time, then it's probably going to be the case that they'll never find that convenient time, and they will never obey the gospel. They will never obey God as they should. In conclusion, then, let me say that a religion of convenience is worthless, except to delude the adherer with a false hope, with a false sense of security. Oh, you know, I'm giving God the crumbs here. Therefore, I'm going to get to heaven. I've got that part taken care of, while the vast majority of my life I can devote to pleasure-seeking and my convenience. That's sad. That's sad. Because the person who is seeking a religion of convenience will find that it will inconvenience him for eternity, I'm afraid. I trust that none of the evil people who didn't want to have their lives inconvenienced by service to God would be models for or examples of anyone here today. That's why I present the lesson, because I don't want that to be the case. Let's not serve God just at our convenience. Let's be willing to put ourselves out when we need to make sacrifices when we need to, in order to serve God faithfully. If you're here and you're not a Christian, I'm sorry to say you're not serving God faithfully. You need to be a child of God. And we urge you, therefore, to do what the Scriptures tell you you must do in order to become a child of God. Come forward in faith and in repentance to make confession of your faith before us in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and finally be immersed, baptized in a body of water as the Scriptures teach, in order that you might become that faithful child of God. We're even going to stand in just a moment to encourage you to step out with that intention and come forward and make your desires known. If you have done that in the past, that is, followed God's process in becoming a child of God, but since then have not been as faithful as you should, maybe you've even brought reproach upon the Lord or His Word or His church in your activities and in your behavior, and you want to let us know that you're sorry for that, we would happily receive you and pray with you. Won't you come? As together for your encouragement, we now stand and sing.